Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, October 27th, 2007. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host today. I was being interviewed on a radio program several weeks ago on the topic of LaRouche's Homeowner and Bank Protection Act. And in the middle of the discussion, the host challenged me on the issue of re-regulating the banks, part of the process of establishing a firewall to protect homeowners and protect local banking and separate out the speculative bubble. And he said there's no authority for such thing granted in the U.S. Constitution. So I pointed out that in the Constitution you do have Article 1, Section 8, but it's also implied in the preamble under the promotion of the General Welfare Clause that this was in fact what was cited by Alexander Hamilton in his successful argument for the constitutional nature of his proposal to establish a national bank. And this was also the basis of Franklin Roosevelt's banking regulation. And the host then said, the preamble has no standing in law. And he said, plus Hamilton's national bank proposal was unconstitutional, it was modeled on the Bank of England, and our system is a free trade system based on Adam Smith, property and rule of law. And this was a man who is considered, or at least considers himself, an expert on the Constitution. Now, I bring this up because today we're going to be discussing the urgent necessity of reestablishing a knowledge of the constitutional tradition and the American system that was created out of it by our early great patriots among the founding fathers and the next generation. And that we're going to do this as the basis for not just saving our nation, which is in grave danger right now, but for reviving this unique tradition as part of a global economic renaissance. 2 weeks ago, Lyndon LaRouche initiated a project to do this, which he called the Cooper Project, named after James Fenimore Cooper, a patriot of that second generation who acted to revive the American system in the 1830s when it was under full-scale assault by a British operation which was using Andrew Jackson to destroy our nation. And I believe Jackson was probably about as bright as our current president, which is to say not that bright. And we're today once again facing a British directed assault against our nation. So this is what we'll be talking with our guest today about this project. Our guest is historian and author Anton Chaitkin, whose books include Treason in America, which is the real story of Aaron Burr, as well as Tony is a co-author of the unauthorized biography of George Herbert Walker Bush. Tony, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Hi, Harley.
And we'll be joined also today by two members of the LaRouche Youth Movement who have taken up a serious interest in this project and have been working extensively on this question of reviving the history of the American system. Nick Walsh, who is in Leesburg, Virginia, and Chris Yaditz, who is out in the West Coast in our Los Angeles office. So they'll be joining us a little later in the show as we go to a roundtable discussion. But Tony, let's start with what was initiated in the last couple of weeks. One of the things that Lyndon LaRouche said is that there's been a complete failure of leadership in both parties to act in this crisis. And in the last couple of days, he's identified the pivotal role of Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, in shutting down any serious discussion of the impeachment of Dick Cheney, and any serious effort to revive the American system as we're facing a banking disintegration because of the financial crisis. So he said we've got to develop once again a competence in economics, particularly the economics of the American system. Now, you were present last weekend at a meeting with Lynn during which there was a discussion of this question of the Cooper Project. Give us an idea of what we'll be doing, and in particular, the kind of work that you're taking up with it.
We had, at the outset of the country and through the 19th century, a quality of leadership that was world-shaping, people who were directly occupied in shaping the future of the world. Just as LaRouche is, that is, we've revived in the LaRouche movement precisely what American leaders were doing, and against the same kind of odds, even though it seems that, you know, we had our own government in this country, and this country developed into a powerful nation. That power came from a set of leaders in not just one generation, but I'd say about three or four. Why people don't know about this, I want to get into a little bit more specifically about some of the idiocies that you expressed in that guy who was talking about Hamilton. But we had different points in our history where the nation was threatened, and the kind of solution that was put through by these patriots, for example, by Hamilton and Washington and Franklin at the outset, by the nationalists in the early 19th century, Lincoln and his followers, and then Franklin Roosevelt, these solutions involved an economic revolution that was for the whole world and immediately affected the whole world and gave us the chance for modern times. The personalities, the history of individual leaders is for someone who has suffered under late 20th century education surprising, totally surprising. In the person of James Fenimore Cooper, for example, people know him generally from a couple of novels that he wrote.
Yeah, The Last of the Mohicans or The Deer Slayer, perhaps.
Right, and he was really one of the top leaders of U.S. military intelligence and global intelligence operating in the United States and in Europe, writing about these subjects and working with the military here to protect the nation. The same thing with his fellow writer, Washington Irving. The history, the personal history of many famous people in that period, such as Jackson, such as Van Buren, is very little understood today. The Democrats have the shame of putting forward the fraud of the so-called Jefferson-Jackson Democratic Party. And, of course, there is no such thing.
Tony, I think that that what we're really looking at that is the Stonewall Jackson. But actually, the treason of these characters, you're right, it's not known. Let me just identify for people. We're on the LaRouche Show. We're talking to Tony Chaitkin, and we're taking up this question of the unknown history of what makes this a unique nation. Tony, in talking about, you opened by saying Washington, Franklin, and Hamilton, who everybody knows.
Thinks they know.
They think they know. And then Lincoln, who also is a character who's being slandered and slammed today with a whole series of psychoanalytic frauds and also just wrong history. But between them, there was also, as you said, three to four generations. There were other people. Cooper is one of them. Irving, you identified. But people like Henry Clay, who else was part of this?
Well, let me go to this, the evidence that I unearthed a few years ago and that we're publishing in the next issue of EIR. There'll be a 10-page article called The Patriot File Unearthed. In 1823, at a real big crisis point in our history, some patriots began a newspaper in New York City called The Patriot, a daily newspaper. And the people who put that out were combating an attempt to destroy the country led by Martin Van Buren, the future president. The leaders of this newspaper were General Winfield Scott, the leading military strategist of the country, John C. Calhoun, a Southern patriot of the United States, opposed to secessionism and states' rights, later known to the public as a states' rights fanatic. James Fenimore Cooper, known today mostly as a writer, as a novelist. President of the United States, James Monroe, who sponsored the paper, his son-in-law, Samuel Gouverneur, arranged the financing for the paper. Joseph Gardner Swift, a general and the leader of West Point, and he and his family were the leading people starting up the building of American railroads and the railroads in Russia. These people set up a newspaper to counter the attempt of Martin Van Buren to destroy the entire U.S. Possibilities for the future. What was happening is that following the War of 1812, the Nationalists, led by Henry Clay and Matthew Carey and John Quincy Adams, began to take over the Jefferson Party. Thomas Jefferson agreed with them in his old age that we needed a nationalist economics, the American system economics identified with Henry Clay. And there was a national unity and consensus behind the presidency of James Monroe. It was called the era of good feeling. Everyone's seen that expression in their history books. What they don't know is that there was a North-South agreement to pursue nationalist economics and to stand up to the British Empire.
Now, Tony, when you say nationalist economics, just define those briefly so that our listeners know what you're talking
about.
It
means that the Bank of the United States, established by Alexander Hamilton, which went out of existence in 1811, its charter lapsed, was revived by national consensus in 1816. And it means that tariffs to protect and promote manufacturing and develop a heavy industry in the United States against the wishes of the British Empire. They were raised and raised and raised again to protect and build up this country. The South, the best leaders in the South agreed with this because they didn't want to have a future of slavery. They wanted a future of national industry. And it also means that the government, with the army playing a leading role, would build canals and railroads and infrastructure.
What they called internal improvements.
Internal improvements.
Yeah.
So this was the policy of this newspaper. Martin Van Buren acted representing his side, which is the British underground in the United States. He started off in the Aaron Burr machine. And when Aaron Burr was tried for treason by Thomas Jefferson, and then fled the country so he wouldn't have to face murder charges for killing Hamilton, he spent some time in England with the head of British intelligence, Jeremy Bentham. He lived in Bentham's house. And then came back to New York and worked with Van Buren.
Now, this is the same Jeremy Bentham of the utilitarian calculus and so on.
Yes.
Burr lived with him.
That's right.
Okay.
All right, so he came back, and Burr and Bentham cooked up an attack against the national unity and national consensus. They said, we need to restore the kind of bitter rancor and fighting that we had in the good old days when Jefferson and Madison and Burr and Gallatin were fighting against Hamilton and Washington. We want to restore that bitterness, and we need a party system to go with it. And the first thing he did was to go down to Virginia and South Carolina and meet with slave owners and say, we need a new party. We will call it the Democratic Party. And this will be based on an alliance of the big Southern plantation owners with the pro-British faction in New York, in New York City and Albany. And we'll call this the Democratic Party. We will go against the Nationalists. We will attack the Monroe administration. And so Monroe and his allies, that is the Nationalists, set up this newspaper to have a war with Van Buren. Now, the central issue at that point internally was whether we were going to continue to build and finish the Erie Canal. At that point, there was, ever since the founding of the English colonies in North America, the British oligarchy, the City of London and the East India Company faction, did not want a continent-wide republic. They did not want a civilization here of peace between the settlers and the Indians. They did not want a great nation to be built here. And so they said, you can't go beyond the mountains. We would not be able to have a nation unless we built a canal system and then a railroad system to give transport back and forth to farmers and settlers in the West. So at first, Van Buren attacked the building of the Erie Canal. The leader of the fight for the canal was DeWitt Clinton. And here you have a man, governor of New York and mayor of New York City, who was allied to Alexander Hamilton. And people who look at their history books, their cheap history books, would say, well, how can that be? Hamilton was in a war against Clinton. Well, not that Clinton. It was his uncle, George Clinton, who took the unfortunate position of opposing the Constitution.
Well, Tony, you know, when you bring this up, the other question that always comes up, and I just want to take a short break here to tell people, if they want to send in questions, send them in to radio@larouchepub.com. We'll take some email questions for our guest and our panel, radio@larouchepub.com. When you bring up the way this fight shaped up, there are very few people who actually know anything about Hamilton. Mostly you hear Hamilton was pro-British, and it raises the question of how he could have been trusted by George Washington and been pro-British. But it seems as though the other side has co-opted the story of Hamilton and completely distorted it.
Well, let's start with the fact that Hamilton was anti-slavery. I think that tells you a little bit to begin with. So you have a certain racial and political problem there with the historians. But Hamilton, when he was Treasury Secretary, founded the Bank of New York before he put together the Bank of the United States. It was a private bank in New York to help intervene in the markets. And Hamilton said at that time, we do not want any other private banks in New York. Which is somewhat astonishing when you think about it, because he was going directly against the financier oligarchy that existed in the city of London and their attempts to get a foothold here in the United States. Who set up the first private bank opposed to Hamilton and the Nationalists? Aaron Burr personally set up the Bank of Manhattan on a swindle. It was Hamilton himself who organized the enterprise of William Cooper, the father of James Fenimore Cooper. He served as Cooper's lawyer to set up Cooperstown and bring in thousands of Americans on the frontier with British Canada.
So Hamilton was the lawyer for Cooper's
mother. Lawyer and his political manager on the whole enterprise in the legislature and elsewhere. The opposing forces were the Prevost family, whose lawyer was Aaron Burr, and who was part of that family by marriage. These are part of British intelligence and the British commanders in the Revolution and the War of 1812. So you're talking about a direct confrontation between the Hamilton forces and the British. Poor Thomas Jefferson was opposed to Hamilton, but he was not a traitor. He was somebody who had chosen wrongly, philosophically, based on his own problems, but in at various points in his life did some patriotic things. But then let us look at why people have gotten slander in their minds against Hamilton. In the 1880s, around 1881, there was a project in New England led by a guy named Morse, not Samuel Morse, to do biographies of Hamilton and Washington and others of the founders, and to have the worst pro-British scoundrels at the time write these biographies. Henry Cabot Lodge wrote the biography of Hamilton. Mm-hmm. Teddy Roosevelt wrote other biographies. Henry Adams was involved, the traitorous grandson of John Quincy Adams.
If I'm not mistaken, isn't Henry Cabot Lodge, wasn't he the person who compiled the writings of Hamilton?
Yes. And what he said about Hamilton is, yes, we love Hamilton. He was a great man. Like us, he was pro-British, his system is British, and He favored the propertied classes against the mass of the people. Now, this in this kind of slander, the British are hoping to have it both ways. That is, they can fight against Hamilton's policies all over the world, in Japan, in Russia, and everywhere else, by name. They can fight against Henry Clay. They can fight against the American system. Lodge couldn't say that Hamilton was not a protectionist, like they say today when the neocons take over his memory, because everybody knew that he was for protection. And he talks about the American system of Henry Clay in that book. But there were a couple of other projects of these same slanderers. They also had something called the Anti-Imperialist League, which was put up by the Boston Brahmins, where they attacked President McKinley, said he was an imperialist, and blamed the war with Spain on him. And this was the same kind of thing as you have today with these so-called anti-globalist rioters that go out to IMF meetings. Instead of having a political attack on the financiers and the Cheney and the British, they have riots. This thing was designed with people like Mark Twain involved to set up McKinley, who is a patriot and anti-British president, to have a coup d'etat against him and to have an assassination. And they put their man Teddy Roosevelt in as president through that kind of a coup d'etat, an assassination. This is the same faction that in the 1870s had a political war against railroads to try to discredit American railroad builders and the railroads themselves, the whole idea of the physical progress of the United States. If you go back to the period of the 1820s, you have a decisive turn in world history under the presidency of Monroe, when Henry Clay was leading the Congress as Speaker of the House, and he put through a bill called the General Survey Act in 1824 to allow West Point engineers, military engineers, to serve private companies at the authorization of the president. This was used in the following years when John Quincy Adams was president to assign West Point engineers to design and plan the first 60 railroads of this country. All those railroads, although they were private companies, were subsidized by different levels of government. These were national projects.
Tony, we're getting at the core of the question. One of the things I'd like to do, I'd like to actually bring Chris in at this point, because he's been doing some work on what you might want to talk about a little bit as the network that was underlying the second and third generation, the Society of Cincinnati. Chris, you've done some work on this. Did you want to bring something up at this point? Chris, you there? Do you have your mute on maybe, Chris?
No.
Okay.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, there's a number of questions I had about the Society of Cincinnati in particular. I mean, there's not really much that you can go out and find about the Society of Cincinnati anymore, even if you go to their building in Washington, D.C. It's just, you really get a sense of the destruction of history that's occurred since basically, well, over a long period of time. But in particular, I wanted to ask you about how does the Society of Cincinnati function in a real specific manner towards, how should I put it, organizing for the World War that the American Revolutionary War eventually turned into, particularly after the peace at Yorktown had been signed?
You can see two great moments for this society. This is the people who had been revolutionary officers with George Washington and who had set up a group to continue the tradition of the revolution. The first moment, of course, is at the Constitutional Convention when George Washington presided at the convention and also presided over a meeting taking place simultaneously over several days of the Society of Cincinnati right there in Philadelphia. And they would also meet informally at Franklin's house to have discussions on what to do with the national economy they were going to have under a republic. It would be a nationalist point of view. So they made sure that the delegates to the convention understood that the revolutionaries would not permit this idea of a totally new society to be abandoned with some populist notions of states' rights or something like that. When you go to the period following the Washington generation and into the 1900s, West Point was established. Washington and Hamilton's dream for a military academy was set up finally in 1802. Franklin's nephew, Jonathan Williams, was the first superintendent. And at that school, U.S. Military Academy, they set up what was called the Military Philosophical Society. And this was, in a sense, an adjunct of the Society of the Cincinnati. Among the members were James Fenimore Cooper, William Cooper Clinton, excuse
mm-hmm.
me.
Okay.
DeWitt Clinton's father, James Clinton, was a leading general there in New York State in the Revolution. John Quincy Adams was a member of the Military Philosophical Society. Robert Fulton was a member of that society. After a few years, they set up across the river in the home of Washington Irving and in the home of a guy named Gouverneur Kemble, a continuation of that society, Military Philosophical Society, which met weekly right up through the Civil War days. And this continued the discussions and the links between the patriotic military officers and foreign people like Lafayette and the Republican networks in Europe for discussions of high strategy, how to defeat the global enemy. The Society of the Cincinnati was directly involved on many fronts. One of them was setting up, for example, the state of Kentucky. They were responsible directly for organizing that. They sponsored the career of the emigrant from Virginia out to Kentucky, Henry Clay. And it was the Society of the Cincinnati leaders such as von Steuben and others, and Hamilton, who was one of the main leaders all the way through the early days of the Society, who organized the settlement on the frontiers and organized the relations to the Indians to keep that a peaceful relationship against the British attempts to have race war all the time. In Europe, Lafayette's organizing as much as he could for American system politics there was mediated largely by James Fenimore Cooper, his closest ally. You hear a lot of slanders against American writers, that Cooper and Poe, both slandered by the same circles. That attack against Cooper began when James Fenimore Cooper wrote a pamphlet at the request of the Marquis de Lafayette in the 1820s. It was about on the subject of the American Constitutional Republic and its superiority to the old European oligarchical forms of government, which caused the pro-British faction in America in the newspapers to go berserk, and in the Whig Party to go berserk against Cooper. Cooper took them to court when they slandered him, and he won all of his cases in court. So
let me ask you on this question. When I've toured Louisiana a number of times and have noticed there are placards up in Baton Rouge in New Orleans where the Marquis de Lafayette delivered speeches in 1824 for the campaign of John Quincy Adams. That was part of the Society of Cincinnatus, again, that brought him in for the Adams campaign?
Yes, for sure. I wouldn't say it for the Adams campaign. Adams emerged as the person that they had to have as president, especially when Clay did not have the support, the national support, to be president.
But this was an intervention to restore and protect this American tradition.
Exactly.
In the presidency.
At a certain point in his tour, it was determined that Adams was the man that the nationalists had to put in as president. But he visited the whole country. It was the most incredible, intensive tour. His greeting in New York was organized by the young James Fenimore Cooper. And Cooper had set up something called the Bread and Cheese Club, which represented the leading lights of thinkers and military strategists in New York City, down the river from the West Point. This tour also took Lafayette to Virginia, where he seems to have met with Edgar Allan Poe, the grandson of a Revolutionary War figure that was important in Lafayette's work in the Revolution. Jeff Steinberg has written about that. He did some tremendous detective work, Jeff did, on the both Cooper and Poe in their travels in Europe in conjunction with this network. So I think his work, along with mine on this subject, is going to be published in the EIR shortly.
Good. I'd like to, let me remind people, this is the LaRouche Show. It's October 27th, 2000. We're discussing the Cooper Project, which is not a bunch of academics sitting around looking at footnotes, but actually fighting to reestablish a principle of leadership, especially among young people, to defend the nation at a point in which the boomer generation has sold out and is pretty much over the hill anyway. But without a new generation of an American system leadership, this country is finished. Now, one of those youth who's one of the initiators of the LaRouche Youth Movement out on the West Coast is with us, and he's been studying quite extensively on the American Revolution. Nick, what do you have to say?
The fight that we're in right now with organizing the population, what Tony's going over in the discussion is really a different universe from what any people of the 18 to 25 bracket today think about. You know, there's no conception of this in, let's say, even say the 18 to 35 bracket. If you look at the bracket of people that actually created the shift in the Congress in 2006 in the last election. Now, just to give a bit of a sense of where we are right now, because it's really, obviously, that's why we're studying this history, we have a crazy election campaign going on with a bunch of clowns running for president now. You have a Congress that stinks to high heaven. They have a 10.7% approval rating. Nobody approves of these guys except for them. Themselves. I think the Congress themselves is probably the 10.7%. But you have a bunch of, in terms of alternatives, you have a bunch of presidential candidates on both sides who are terrible. Now, what LaRouche has been focusing in on recently is that Nancy Pelosi is deliberately preventing our Congress from doing anything useful. And she consorts on a regular basis with the fascist Felix Roatan, who is part of the banking circles that actually brought Adolf Hitler into power in Germany for the last great so-called World War. This guy is a student, a protege of this guy Meyer, Andre Meyer, who ran the Hitler Project.
Tony, just on that, would you say that Roatan is in the Burr tradition?
Yeah, except Burr was born in America. Rowatan is more in the tradition of Gallatin and Schacht and people like that who are from Europe and who are trying to. I mean, we had PBS. He's certainly in the Burr tradition for sure within our history.
Mm-hmm.
Why did Democrats look to somebody like Rowatan? How do they get away with it? First, they do it because they're afraid and they feel like it's better to take some money and be sheepish. But this tradition, they would say, for example, I'm in the Andrew Jackson tradition. What is Jackson? Jackson, when Burr was put on trial for treason, when Jefferson put Burr on trial for treason, for trying to break off the Western USA and in league with the British, Andrew Jackson was subpoenaed by the government as a witness because he had helped Burr in Burr's treason, and he knew a lot about it. So he came to Richmond, and while the trial of Burr was going on, Andrew Jackson stood in the street attacking President Jefferson as a tyrant. And this scoundrel, this ruffian, this man who was known as a racist Indian murderer in the West, a disgraceful man, was cooked up as a presidential candidate by Martin Van Buren and Burr later on. And as a result of him becoming president, posing as a nationalist when he ran for president, by the way, he never said, I'm going to take down the Bank of the United States, I'm going to stop the tariffs, I'm going to leave the nation open to British domination overseas. But when he came in 1829, for the next 30 years, this country was plunged into free trade and a succession of rotten presidents, so that the chief product of the country, by default, became cotton. And the southern slave owners became dominant in U.S. politics, just like they have recently. They may not be called slave owners today, but that's what the free trade system is about. And everybody knows that. You don't have to hear the Southern accent to know what the Southern strategy of Nixon was. It wasn't about just the U.S. South. It was about this situation where imperialism, invading Mexico, treating other countries like as if they were not human, and so forth. That is the decision that was being made back in the time that we've been talking about, back in the 1820s.
So let me just get back to Nick then, because Nick, you were saying that this is essentially what we see with Rowatan then with this campaign now.
Yeah, we have a major international crisis. You have the collapse of the financial system. Our government, based on some of these principles and this leadership that developed our country, is crucial. To solving, it's essential, it's necessary to solve this problem. Our government has to intervene. And our government is now being held hostage by all of its available limbs are being strapped down by the British financial oligarchy and their channels, like Felix Rowatan, George Shultz, through people like Nancy Pelosi, our terrible administration, Dick Cheney, and these folks. And LaRouche was bringing up that you have, for example, you have this problem with, in California specifically, that's where the Democratic Party is controlled through this Rowatan, Schwarzenegger, Nazi Kennedy clan.
That wing of the Kennedy clan, the people within the Kennedy family that decided they would go with Schwarzenegger.
Yeah. Right. And that. So you have this problem. Now, you also have around Giuliani's campaign the real revival of the Children of Satan. I mean, basically what we published in the Children of Satan, these guys are all flocking to Rudy Giuliani's campaign. I think if you want to vote for him, you have to vote for him on October 31st. But now the thing is, so what's the population responding to? What is wrong, let's say, in the campuses? Or with the youth today, the 18 to 35 bracket, why aren't they responding? They're hooked today on things like MySpace, on computer games, on, you know, virtual reality of all kinds of different types. You get this brain-dead, zombie-like atmosphere in where youth congregate together. The social principles governing youth culture today is, or, you know, pornography, virtual reality, violence, rock and roll music, but really this, what you see on MySpace, where people invent their own personalities, they invent their own images. It's no connection at all to this history that you guys are going through. And so how do we break this? I mean, how do we actually, the question relevant now for anyone living and thinking today, is how do we rip people, some even individuals, out of this coma that the culture has them in, that the society has people gripped in, this MySpace coma, and get them to realize the value of the United States in American history? And I've just been reading a bit of Cooper so far. I'm just starting to dig into him. And the fun thing about him is he really, his novel, I'm reading The Spy. And in The Spy, it's a drama. And I think we need to be creating these dramas.
Well, actually, I want to get you an email question, Tony, directly related to what Nick just brought up.
Yeah, that's great.
This is from Lewis Wilden in the War Room, who said he's in the middle of reading The Deerslayer.
Great.
And he said what he finds interesting is the main character who represents the best impulses of the missionaries and the Indians as he was raised between both. But what he goes through then is what, in discussing with Lynn on this, the idea of how do you go out and expand a great nation westward, bringing the best of European culture there. And, you know, that he, Lewis in his email refers to the fact that Cooper is not really writing novels, but strategic historical studies inspired by the method of Schiller. And I just saw this quote recently from Cooper praising Schiller.
Yes.
So take this up. How do you do this with, how do you make it dramatic so people actually understand this? Because I know if there's one thing about you, Tony, you are very dramatic when you present it. But what is that quality that we've got to bring back to get people excited about their own minds as opposed to what is virtual reality?
Well, the first thing is you have to say things that are very dangerous. That might get you in deep trouble with the reader and other people. In that Deerslayer, there's a discussion at the point of a danger. Somebody's been kidnapped and so forth, and there's a discussion between the Indian and the white man about fundamentalist religion and empiricism. And they're talking because the issue is, can an individual of any race have universal ideas, important ideas, and play a role in world history? So they're having this confrontation, these two men, the scout and the Indian, who are very, very dear friends, but coming from different cultures. And this is something which gets on people's nerves then as now. Because you're raising the issue about is there a better culture than some other culture? Students of history in those days, in the early 1800s, the Republican students of history said, let's look at the history of the Indians and see how some among them in the Americas developed high culture and astronomy and how others didn't. Why do some people in the world develop that? How does mankind get agriculture that lifts us out of the depths because it gives us a surplus to employ people to think? So these are universal ideas. Cooper wrote three novels on this, on the direct confrontation with the enemy European oligarchy. One of them is The Bravo, about the Venetian leaders and their inquisition as terrorists against mankind. That got him in real trouble. Another one is called The Headsman, set in Switzerland. It's about the executioner, and he's responding to the idea of Joseph de Maistre, that so-called Catholic Freemason, who said that the executioner should be the leader of society. And he's showing why that's wrong. And another book called The Heidenmauer, personally published by Henry C. Carey, and I've seen the letters between them on that question of the book, The Heidenmauer, written by Cooper, is about the barons in Europe who are running religious warfare and in the Reformation. And behind these contentions in religion are the interests of the European, the evil old European leadership to try to hang on to feudalism. So these are questions which are dangerous to bring up and which got Cooper in a lot of trouble. Let me say that those leaders in that period have been the inspiration for any future progress that occurred. Abraham Lincoln was a child and a teenager in the era of the 1820s when Quincy Adams was president, and saw our government and our leadership fight to develop canals and then railroads and to develop the West in a humanistic way against all the odds. And this inspired Lincoln with optimism about conquering nature and about peaceful relations with other races and not having an imperialist point of view. Franklin Roosevelt looked back on Lincoln and looked back on these nationalists like Henry Clay and looked back to Hamilton, Franklin Roosevelt's ancestor, Isaac Roosevelt, was a right-hand man to in that state of New York. So Roosevelt looked back to the success and the promise of these humanists, including Thomas Jefferson and in his role as writing the Declaration of Independence and standing up to the British at different times. And he took the best of this American heritage in his ultra, ultra dangerous task of facing down the Wall Street colony of Britain in this time when we had to stand up to all those fascists who had put Hitler into power, and to rally our country to do again, in even a better way, what was done by the people who built our railroads and our industries to begin with.
That's our task today. And for those of you out there listening who wish to become more dangerous, let me just, before we continue, urge you to go online to the LaRouchePack.com to follow this fight as it's evolving. And also subscribe to the EIR online, which you can do by calling us at 800-278-3135. That's 800-278-3135. I'd like to bring Chris back in here, because I know from talking to him over the last few days that he had a lot of questions and also a lot of thoughts. So, Chris, come on back in.
Yes. Can you hear me okay this time?
Yes.
Okay. Well, just one thing in particular that has come up already, but something that I really wanted to hear expounded on, is that LaRouche set up the organization. At least he said so in prior discussions, that the organization is set up much in the same way that the Society of the Cincinnati was set up, both as an intelligence organization, both in principle, and I've always found, not just in my personal investigations of family history, but also in investigations of the American history, that you really get a sense of what the mission is and what the fight is when you look back on this history. And so I wanted to get a little more perspective. How can we as organizers, as political organizers, really make the American Revolution, make this fight alive? How can we convey what's being conveyed in this Cooper Project on a day-to-day basis in field organizing, in discussions that we're having with our congressional contacts and our state contacts in pushing the Homeowners Bank and Protection Act? I'd like to get some on that.
Go ahead, Tony. It's a good question.
We have today a monopoly on the field, really. I was just out here in Loudoun County this morning putting out our material on the showdown with the local Nazis who got a guy running for sheriff here who's in with Blackwater and these pro-Franco crazies in the Catholic Church and so forth. And we are now in a contest where the economic crisis gives us a choice, either a Franklin Roosevelt solution or Hitler. And it's that simple. There isn't some other choice because you have a system collapsing, and these Nazis on their side use the same crisis that LaRouche is facing in terms of the collapse of people's housing and jobs and future. We're appealing to them to rally to solve it and to advance civilization worldwide. And the other side is demonizing immigrants, calling for war against Muslims, and cooking up a war against Russia. So it's as simple as that kind of showdown. Now, I'm out there on the street with the LaRouche literature, meeting people at a Department of Motor Vehicles, and there is no one else taking this on directly. Since 1966, when LaRouche had his first, taught the class in New York City that recruited the first round of people that joined him.
And you were one of those first recruits, weren't you?
I was there, yes. So I can tell you something about
President of the creation, as they say.
But this was a couple of years after the Kennedy assassination. And he was said in that class that there is a world, that was astonishing to many in the 1960s, there is a world and that exists as a world economy. There's world trade, there's production, advanced production. This is susceptible of being directed one way or another. And financiers in power at that time were, as he said, changing the strategy for the world economy to direct investment into speculation and usury and destroying the poor, that unless they were taken from power and the policy that they were putting in was changed, we would have fascism and the destruction of civilization. He proposed at that time that we, in his class and associating with him, should do the moral thing and take the world out of the hands of those financiers. And that was the basis, after the first class that evening, for forming a political organization. That contest, head-to-head, as we did over the succeeding years, we got in a position of fighting for directing that policy one way or the other. We were involved with top level people in the American administration and in other countries. We continue to play that role increasingly with Lin's prestige and his demonization by this oligarchy. But it is a head-to-head contest for the world. And if somebody wants to determine a beautiful world or a pestilence, it's up to them. Mostly kids and younger people have the mental fortitude and the imagination left to say, I want to be in on that creation. I want to be part of that decision. But you have to put it on that level. It's either a future that we determine by this fight, a war against the misleadership in Congress, for example, and determine a future. But that it has to be put on that level of decision.
I think also the other point that Mr. LaRouche has been making in the last days is there has to be bite to it, the same way Tony's has been discussing it, that this is not a question of a difference of opinion, that there is a scientific way of determining which economic policies are right and which are wrong, and that, in fact, the people who are promoting, for example, free trade, either they're completely ignorant of economic history, which in many cases you find that they are, or they deliberately are trying to impose a policy which will turn the vast majority of the population into human cattle. And one of the things you have to do when you're talking to someone is ask them, are you a human cattle, part of the human sheep, or are you a real person? Do you believe that we can change our destiny? And that's, in a sense, the way Cooper poses it, the way Friedrich Schiller poses this question. And I know, Chris, you've been working on the Don Carlos recently. The issues that are the subtext in Schiller's great play, Don Carlos, is precisely that. None of the characters are any good. There's a crisis. The world's going to hell. And Schiller's addressing the people in the audience. And we have to create those kinds of dramas inside the minds of the people with whom we're talking to give them a hunger to get at what is, what it means to be human. And that's something that has always been the approach of Lyndon LaRouche. And as Tony said, that these were people who were dangerous people. We all have to become that kind of dangerous person to win the fight. Nick, did you have some thoughts on that?
Well, it's something something LaRouche really developed the idea of about a year ago, was this concept of the mass effect. Because we're dealing, in all of our organizing, we're dealing with the fact that society itself is the disease. So how do you organize people in a society where the problem is the society? It's a funny paradox. You have to, the fact that the society is the disease has to always be part of the subject of the organizing process. And if it's not, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
But that means that we can't ever be looking, in a sense, for a simple agreement with people based on any of the predicates of this society. The only agreement we can reach with people in organizing is they have to begin to agree to principles which we know, from looking at this society, don't exist in this society. So we've got to rip people out of this culture. Now, there's no way to do that and be popular. There's no way to actually organize anybody today without being unpopular and without other people who are going to defend this society coming after you. And what LaRouche said is the people that defend MySpace, the people that promote MySpace, are our enemies. The Rupert Murdoch circles, obviously, who own MySpace, are clearly our enemies. This is the British Empire. The people controlling this society from the top down are the British. And they are the enemies of the human race, and they're our enemies of our political movement. So, and LaRouche said, it was funny, he said, if you're really doing this, if you're actually being leadership in this sense, then they're going to come after you. And he said, if someone's not trying to kill you or trying to put you in prison, you're probably not doing good leadership. He said, there's other ways to get in jail that aren't leading. You know, you don't want to do that. But if we have to actually do this mass effect idea where we're going to go out and say, we have to have a dynamic effect on a region that we're organizing in, where we actually alter the dynamic that's controlling that, the social process in that region. It's called the mass effect. So we have to start to organize that way. We have to actually uproot the way that people are relating to each other, free them of these British oligarchy determined principles of social relations.
And that's clear to anyone who's trying to get this Homeowner and Bank Protection Act through, because you have all kinds of idiocy out there about what is the real economy and so on. We're down to about 2 minutes, and Tony, I'd like to give you a chance to wrap it up. There is an email from Scott Bailey that I'm going to ask George to get to you.
Okay.
And you can answer that. But just summarize this, Tony. Where are we going with this?
Well, say something about Nick's point about unpopular. Yes, but you use the flank. And with the Homeowners Bank Protection Act, we are going to the flank where people are threatened. And they're of two minds. They are of the popular mind, popular idiocy, but they're also threatened. And they can be moved into a force. Lincoln did the same thing when he ran for president. The population was not, they were idiots on the race question. They were not hostile to slavery in the North, by and large. But he was a protectionist, and he ran on a program to protect the jobs of people who were depression racked. Free trade had destroyed their jobs in 1857 in a crash. And so he mobilized people for an economic policy and to defend the power of our nation to give anybody a future. And in that process, in that mobilization, he showed people by bringing, for example, 200,000 black troops into the army and other means that their racial attitudes were absurd. And so that the universal idea of mankind, which he always had, and which was in his fiber from knowing the history of our country and its struggle against the European oligarchy, he used the flank of the future of our people and also the future of mankind, and made people in America become universal citizens. We were proud to be giving what we were developing to the world, and that flank that we have today is both the act that LaRouche has brought in and the alliance with the great powers abroad to give humanity a future.
And Tony, we're going to have to stop at that. I think people should get on the website, follow this Cooper project, become a part of it, read the works of Cooper, and follow it through the LaRouchePact.com. Chris, thanks for being with us. Nick, thanks for your participation. And Tony, thanks a lot, and we'll have to do this again. This has been the LaRouche Show. Join us next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, and we'll see you then.